This podcast is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Hello, you're very welcome to the Alison Spittle Show with me, Alison Spittle. I've practically lost my voice this week, and I just got a really, really, really bad flu. So, hello. This week's show is with Emma Demiri. She is a fantastic lady that I met doing the Cutting Edge with Brendan O'Connor show on RTE a year ago. And I've always wanted her on my podcast because I just think she's just so interesting. And we ended up talking about a lot of stuff in great detail that I didn't get to ask her other stuff because we kind of ran out of time. But I'm just very aware of how my voice sounds, so I'll let you listen to Emma and a more better immune system me. This was a few weeks ago. I'll chat to you after. Bye.
Hello.
Hiya, Alison. Hi. To see you.
You're very welcome to the podcast, Emma.
It's lovely to be here. I love your studio. It's very nice.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Before, I mean, we didn't have a round table. We had like a square table and someone was sitting in the office doing work. And now we've got more soft bits, which I presume makes it more soundproof.
They do something to the quality of the sound.
They do.
Well. It's an absorption. It is quite warm, actually.
Yeah,
you thought that
I
would
told
happen,
you.
And I doubted you.
I'm sorry for being right.
Sorry for being so doubtful. I'm going to take my card.
Do go for it. Go for it.
I guess it's when the fan comes off.
Yeah, yeah. Then you're like, the heat is here straight away. Yeah. Straight away. So we met on the Cutting Edge on the Brendan O'Connor show.
Did.
Which was good crack. Well, I wouldn't say good crack. It was.
Do you know what? Given the some of the material,
yeah,
was slightly somber. I still had good crack.
Yeah,
so, yeah,
yeah. I liked being at the after bit.
Yeah,
had, like prosecco.
Yeah, that was lovely. Nice. I always love prosecco.
Yeah, prosecco's really
too
good.
Too much, perhaps.
But I've always wanted you on the podcast, so thank you so much for coming on.
No, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, and I hear that you want to set something straight. In regards to America trying to claim you?
No, America's not trying to claim me.
Who is?
Well, I don't know. No one's trying to claim me. People are trying to, like, what's the word? Disown me, rather.
What?
So, yeah, I'm not American. I wasn't born in America. So it all started, like, I don't even know where it started. I think there was something misprinted in a newspaper article that said I was born in America, and then it quoted me directly saying I wasn't born in America, saying that I was actually born in Ireland in the same piece.
Wow.
But lots of people seem to be reading that now, and when they're writing stories about me saying Emma was born in America. And while an American passport would be brilliant and like very, very handy, sadly, I'm not eligible for one because I was born in the Rotunda in Dublin, Dublin born and bred. So, yeah, I'm not a Yank.
So you lived in America, though?
Yeah, I lived in America. So, and again, this might be where the confusion comes from. I moved to America when I was like a few months old.
Right.
And we stayed there for like 4 or 5 years and then back to Dublin. But I was definitely born in this country on Irish soil. And I keep asking people to correct it as well, and then they just ignore me. So yeah, there's this rumor is spreading, yeah. But I'm not American.
So did you ever go to kindergarten or anything like that? Do you remember anything about America when you were that young?
I actually remember loads about America, which is quite unusual, I think, to remember a lot about those kind of years of your life.
Mm.
But I have quite clear memories, and I often think it's because my life in America, the contrast between my life in America and my life as soon as I moved back to Dublin was so vast that it's made the memories of America sharper.
Mm.
I think maybe if there'd been more similarity or continuity between the experiences when I was kind of 3 and 4 and then the experiences when I was like 5 and 6, it would all kind of blur into one. But because there's such a sharp distinction between them, America is quite, looms quite large in my memory.
And what would be the biggest differences as a child for you between America and Ireland?
So something that really jumps out at me is, I guess up until I moved to Ireland, which was when I was like moved back to Ireland because I was born here.
Caught you out.
Snared. She's a yuck. I don't think I put my phone on airplane. Let me do that.
Okay. Yeah.
I can't actually hear it. I just saw it light up.
Nice.
With a really good message, actually.
Yay.
Brilliant. But let me.
Do you want to reply to it if you want?
No. It's
you
there, sure? There's no rush. Yeah.
Cool.
So I just had no concept of race or the idea that I was black. And sure, why would a 4-year-old particularly be thinking about stuff like that? But it was like, as soon as I came back to Ireland, I was just like, oh, I'm a black person. And that's not what most people are. And that's like a bad thing and people don't like it.
Yeah.
So that would be one of the first things that I was taught. And then also, this is like Dublin in like 1984. It was just really poor. Like the quality of life was like markedly different to that I experienced living with my wealthy Nigerian grandparents in like a beautiful glass house in an American suburb.
Yeah.
Kind of moving to Rialto. In a house with like no heating, that was like freezing. Life, the quality of life just seemed very, very different.
Oh my God. It's like, because my grandparents and my dad's side is really rich, but I grew up in a council estate.
Yeah, so I totally understand those contradictions.
Yeah. And it was so weird because I was like, you know, any summer holiday I go to my rich grandparents and go, woohoo, respite.
Exactly.
It was so,
And that was also another mad thing for me. Like then my grandparents moved back to Nigeria. They'd been living in the States while we were there. They moved back to Nigeria. We moved back here. They moved back to Nigeria. And I remember going to Nigeria then when I was maybe 7 or 8 and seeing my grandparents' house, and it was like really big and impressive. And then they had like chauffeur and like cooks and really like flash cars with like electric windows. Like you could press a button and the window went up and down, which I know is like completely unremarkable now.
No, but like yeah.
In the mid-80s to me, this was like absolutely crazy. But also it was like I was in school, like I was in a convent school. And that's another thing that's being, people, Emma went to like a string of expensive schools. I did go to Alexandra College for 3 years, but most of the school, and I went to a lot of schools, but most of the schools I went to were just state schools, just normal schools. So that's another mistake that I would like to rectify. I was in school, in a convent school, and what we were told about Africa was, you know, just like starving black babies and like the Trokara box and the Ethiopian famine and like just all of that stuff, right? And then I'm going to Nigeria and I'm just like, no, like this is like a wealth like I've never experienced before or certainly never seen in Ireland. And then I remember going back to school and trying to like explain that and getting into a lot of trouble.
What, because people didn't believe you?
I was actually like hauled out of my class and told I shouldn't be making up stories.
Oh my
and
God.
And I had a massive chip on my shoulder. I think it was when I resisted the penny for the black baby because I said, I don't know that they need it. Like they seem
that
richer than us.
So fucked up.
Yeah.
Because you
can
excuse.
We curse?
yeah, we can. Sorry. Because...
I think I keep snorting, sorry.
we got anti-snorting tech. No, we don't.
So I'm sorry, listeners. I have a runny nose. I've lost the run of myself.
You're fine. I've got sleep apnea. They're used to weird sounds coming out of us. And that,
brilliant.
Like that.
Lovely.
I'm turning into George Hook.
Thanks for that slurf as well.
I know. No, we'll step away. This is a podcast, different rules.
Deadly.
Because it's so weird about Irish people, because generally we kind of excuse our racism because we're like, we weren't brought up in a multicultural atmosphere, so therefore we don't know how to act. But you'd think if you had a person of colour in your class, you wouldn't go penny for the black baby. You'd go, I don't know. Do you know, whatever about if there's loads of whites and you don't think about it?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But that's disgusting.
And then especially if they're like challenging it and being like, oh, well, I've actually like been to the place that you're talking about. And like, some people are rich. They have skyscrapers.
Why is it bad? Why is it bad if there are rich people? It's not like you're trying to stop people giving money or... Anyway, sorry. I can't talk about it properly. It just drives me insane. What was Alexandra College like then? Because you were there for 3 years.
I didn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
Let's say. I didn't thrive there.
Is it like kind of Enid Blyton? What is it? Is it like what a boarding it? School? Or?
Yeah, it is a boarding school. Okay. I didn't board. It was usually people like from the country who boarded, or maybe English people who were like kind of who were middle class and had money but maybe couldn't afford to go to boarding school in England because it's a lot more expensive there,
right,
than Irish boarding schools. So yeah, there were a few English people as well, and we had like English teachers, like teachers from England and stuff, so it had a kind of an Englishy vibe,
right,
like, I guess it's a Protestant school as well, but I guess it probably didn't have loads of English people, but it had more English people than like an ordinary Irish school would have.
Yeah,
what was the crack with there? So I was getting bullied in school, basically. My mum was like, oh, well, let's try something different. Like, let's kind of try a private school. And she got the money together to like send me there. But it was a snobby place. And like, I was living in Rialto. So there was a lot of kind of, oh, like there's this like black girl, and it probably would have been grand if I was like black and was like the Nigerian ambassador's daughter or something and lived in like a big mansion house on wherever the Nigerian ambassador lived, but like I think it was that double whammy of being like black and living in Rialto. I was just kind of looked on with suspicion and wasn't seen as a suitable friend for lots of the girls. I remember people telling me one of my friends telling me, this is when I was 12, that another one of our friends, their mother had invited loads of people around in the house. I was invited. And the mum had sat them down and just kind of told them why I wasn't an appropriate friend. And it was along the lines of, there were things, I've never deciphered or found out what these things were, but apparently there were things that were suitable for somebody, behaviours that were suitable for a girl from my cultural background that wouldn't be suitable for like normal Irish girls.
Okay.
So I don't know what they were.
I would love to find that.
Me too.
Jesus Christ. So you did your junior cert there and went on to somewhere else.
I did my
else.
Junior cert there, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you, what did you study in university?
So in university, I studied African studies. And so yeah, I moved to London to go to university to do African studies and history. So I did, I did a double degree.
And what aspect, when you do... history in uni, because the Leaving Cert and Junior Cert kind of focus on like World War II mostly.
Yeah.
So what did you study when you were doing history?
Yeah, so I'd done history in school. Like I did history for my leaving, but that was, like Irish history and the World Wars and that kind of stuff. And then...
Do you know what was weird in primary school for history? We were taught about the Minotaur. That's not historical. Do you know what I mean? That's not real.
I actually love that kind of mix of mythology and history.
Yeah.
Because when you go into kind of like prehistory, like a lot of it is mythical origins. So that's quite an innovative approach to it.
Yeah, that was so weird. That was in my primary school history book.
It's definitely not like a real historical figure. It's
a
bull
be.
Man.
No, like a bull's head.
Yeah,
I feel
not,
we'd have some skeleton. Do you know what I mean?
To prove his existence.
Yeah, he'd be in like some museum in London or something.
Because I did classics and he popped up there, but like you'd expect him there, not like in history.
Not in primary. Because Joe's weird. I went to school in England and I went to school in Ireland. And history in England, they never teach about colonialism. And it's so weird. because I know. English people or British people generally don't know why people are angry with them. Yeah, and it's if they were taught it, they'd have a better understanding.
Exactly.
From a young age, like for them.
But you know what? I actually think that really great inroads are being made, I think, on British TV. And there's a lot of history programs being made that are correcting that historical narrative.
Yeah.
But I don't think that shift has happened within the education system. Yeah, I mean, it hasn't. And I don't know when it's going to happen within the kind of, the national curriculum. And I used to think, you know what, if people were just shown the truth, then they'd be able to engage with it and respond to it and probably shift their opinions. But what I've realised from being involved in like a lot of those history programmes that are kind of presenting a more accurate depiction of the colonial past is that it actually often doesn't make people reflect. It just makes them dismissive. And they're like, what's going on? A phrase I learned recently is cultural Marxism. They're like, this is cultural Marxism.
Whoa.
So they don't see it as accurate. They see it as some sort of like far left plot
to destabilize
the country and to rewrite history, as opposed to just a more accurate representation of the actual history.
It's like, because like my dad's English and he's very proud of being English, right? And when I was a kid, I lived in Ireland and I was like, I'm going to move back to London as soon as I can because I hate this place and everything. And like people would slag me off over my English accent and it would be like a joke for them and it's fine. And it was a joke. But I used to take it really personal. I'd be like, anti-English sentiment. But then I read a history book and read what happened with the Empire. And I was like, yeah, fair enough. Keep it going.
Yeah, totally. I think it is hard, though, for the children of Irish parents who have English accents, though, because it's not like they're hardly responsible for what the Crown did or for British colonialism. They're probably actually being born in England kind of to an extent because of British colonialism, because there's so much migration out of there was so much migration out of Ireland because there were so few opportunities here. And then obviously they have an English accent and if they come back here, they're kind of penalised for that, even though they might have been brought up with like a very strong sense of being Irish and being Irish people in England. I know a lot of people who've experienced that and found it very disorienting and very upsetting.
I know, it's quite sad. I know a few people that have English accents and are very Irish. I know a girl who has an English accent and she works for the National Leprechaun Museum and
I love that place.
It's so great.
It's brilliant.
It is brilliant. Everyone thinks it's shite because of the name.
The name doesn't do it justice at all. Like I was just, God, what's this? And my mum telling me about it.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
And you just learn so much about like so ancient much. Ireland and everything. Because I'm from a place called Ballymore, which is one village away from Kildare, which is like the ancient centre point of Ireland, where the five provinces used to meet up and stuff. But anyway, she's really passionate about like ancient Ireland and people don't believe her because of her accent.
Yeah.
And it actually impedes her job.
No, I'm sure.
Because her job is her, you know.
Yeah. No, I often think about why there's such, I guess, defensiveness or maybe like passion and emotion surrounding Irish accents. But I this is purely speculative, but it's what I think. Because we don't speak Gaelic anymore, well, of course there are people that do, but generally, like most of us are communicating day to day in English. Because we're speaking English and not Irish, I think the kind of marker of your Irishness, of your identity as Irish, is your accent, because it's not your language.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
I watched Black 47 yesterday and I didn't give a second thought to the Irish language before, but then I saw how people were being punished for speaking the language that they were born with, and I was like, oh my God, this is really fucked up, and I wish I did better at my junior cert level Irish, or you know, and I do understand why people hold on to it. It's so weird though, because like everybody was eating, and like someone brought in like a takeaway into Black 47. I was like, this is not appropriate because it's a film about the famine. You know, you just hear people crunching on nachos.
Or maybe they're just showing like that we triumphed and now we have nachos.
Definitely. Neil Delamere has a great joke. He says like, you know, that Ireland used to have you know, the famine, and now we're the most obese country in Europe. And brilliant. He says, that's a comeback. He says, that's an amazing comeback.
The sign of our success.
Yeah, I know.
But I love the Irish language. That's another thing. Like in school, I felt, because my Irishness was like challenged and questioned like so much. Oh, I forgot I had makeup on and I've just streaked it all across my face. deadly. But no one can see, so it's fine. Because my Irishness was like kind of questioned and challenged so much. And I just like wasn't really like that kind of applied in school. Mm. I just really resented learning Irish. Like, I mean, I learned it like from the beginning. But I was just like, oh, why am I learning this? And I was just like, it's relevant. And I just had a bad attitude towards it. And also the way it was taught, like it just seemed, it seemed so boring. But also I had lots of issues surrounding my own Irishness. So I just felt like disconnected. But it was only when I got much older, it was probably when I had left, actually when I'd left Ireland, and I started trying to learn my dad's language. When I was doing my degree in African studies, I took Yoruba, which is my dad's language. I started trying to learn that. And I started kind of really seeing the parallels. Well, seeing that shared history like between Nigeria and Ireland via colonialism, and seeing the parallels between the suppression of Yoruba language and the suppression of Gaelic, and being like, oh God, I can't even speak Gaelic. And then I started just like reading more about the Irish language and like kind of what had happened with its loss or its suppression. And I just started teaching myself. Like I have like loads of Irish kind of beginner's books, which I never thought I'd have any interest in before. And I've taught my son like very like kind of basic Irish. And he loves like, we'll have these like very basic exchanges in Irish. And obviously he's like born in England and going to school in England, but he loves it. And I'm like, yeah, I'd love to go to like the Gaeltacht and really like immerse myself in it. And because it must all be in there as well, because I learned it for years.
Yeah, it's dormant.
So, I need to activate it.
And Urabel is like, is how common is that spoken in
Yoruba?
Yoruba. Is that commonly spoken in Nigeria, or is it similar to Gaelic?
So it's definitely more commonly spoken than Gaelic is here.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a big division. There's a big class division and a big division in terms of who has access and who has opportunities for social advancement and progress, in that if you only spoke Yoruba, you're definitely like not part of the Nigerian elite or successful class. They speak English. They speak like kind of impeccable, often British accented English. So there's a real class distinction between who speaks English and who doesn't.
Oh my gosh.
And also, so my family would all speak English. They would speak Yoruba as well, but definitely like as a secondary, as a secondary language. And I remember asking my grandfather before he passed away about some, because I am like a scholar of like African studies, and I do a lot around like Yoruba kind of philosophy and cosmology, but I have to access it through English, obviously, because I don't speak Yoruba. I remember asking my grandfather about some like really beautiful philosophical concept in Yoruba, if he could like explain it for me, because I was struggling with it. And he was just like, no, my Yoruba is actually not good enough to be able to explain that to you. Whoa. It's kind of too archaic, the idea. And I was like, oh, that's really sad. People would still use it, but they'd kind of often be more familiar with English.
And just when you said like that due to colonialism, like Nigeria and Ireland has some things in common, is there anything else they have in common other than like the kind of loss or keeping on to a language?
They're both British colonies. Obviously Nigeria was colonized a lot later than Ireland was, but for the kind of 300 or 400 years preceding its colonization, it was being it was having like a huge amount of its population shipped overseas to be enslaved. And then when that was kind of no longer like financially expedient, they were like, oh, why don't we just set a base here actually and colonize it. And then there's the argument that people have made that Ireland was kind of like a laboratory for the colonial project. Like they practiced a lot of what they were going to do in Britain, in Africa, and India, kind of in the 800 years they were chilling here.
Yeah, chilling. So would that be like suppressing the language then as quickly as possible? And like, what about religious rights?
Stuff around religion, stuff about around language, stuff around colonial administration, I guess, like who's going to rule, all these kind of like divide and conquer kind of things that you see emerging between maybe different classes, different groups, different ethnic groups in Nigeria. So Nigeria has like three main ethnic groups. They are the Hausa, the Yoruba, which is my one, and the Igbo. They all had different experiences of kind of colonial religion. But Christianity, like Church of England. So the three C's of colonialism were Christianity, commerce and civilization. So they were like, we're here for Christianity, commerce and civilization.
Yeah.
So part of kind of modernity and being... seen as kind of leaving like your primitive, like savage ways behind you was like conversion to Christianity.
Yeah.
So you see kind of mass conversions to Christianity, like in Nigeria. And obviously to access school and stuff, that would be through Christian schools, mm-hmm. to access the kind of the new formal colonial state that's being created. Often Christianity was like a necessary component of that. I'm happy to say my family were Muslim. so yeah, not Christian.
And could you be a practicing Muslim during colonial times, or what would happen there?
Yeah, I know that they were, the British were quite threatened by Islam in a lot of African countries. But then I don't know what it was like. I don't know what it was like in Nigeria. I don't think there was any... There was no forced kind of conversion from my family, like into Christianity. Like they remained Muslim. And my grandfather was a high court judge,
right,
in Nigeria, and he was obviously able to do that and be Muslim. So I don't know. I never really thought about that, and I can't ask him because he's no longer with us.
Oh, I'm sorry. Cool. Jesus, I got a big lesson there. Thanks so much.
Sorry, going on.
No. It's good. I'm asking because I want to know. I'm going to ask you about your book.
Yeah.
Tell me about your book.
Yeah. So I've just finished what is pretty much the final draft of my first book, which is called Don't Touch My Hair. And... oh God, it's about like, okay, so ostensibly it's about hair. It's about black hair and the kind of politics around black hair. Mm. But it's about a lot more as well. Could I just read the short blurb?
Yeah, I do.
Because that just helps me, you know, like condense
all my
ideas. Because otherwise I'll just be all over the place.
That I felt like that about my TV show as well. Like, it's so, because you know, you have it in about four sentences and you're like,
exactly.
Yes, this is it.
This just sums it up rather than like my meandering.
And you've so many other feelings about it that's not what the person that's consuming it is going to get from it either, because you worked on it.
Exactly. Okay, so.
Yes.
Recent years have seen the conversation around black hair reach tipping point, yet detractors still proclaim it's only hair when it never is. So this book seeks to reestablish the cultural significance of African hairstyles, using them as a blueprint for decolonization. So I set myself quite a challenge there. but and obviously I didn't write this. Over a series of wry, informed essays.
There's the Irish part of you coming out where you're like, disclaimer, I don't think I'm wry or informed.
That's how I would describe myself, Julie. Yeah. The author takes us from pre-colonial Africa through the Harlem Renaissance, Black Power, and into today's natural hair movement, into the cultural appropriation wars and beyond. We look at everything from, we don't look at everything, but we do look at the trajectory from hair capitalists like Madam C.J. Walker to the rise of Shea Moisture today. That's a big hair brand that's had like lots of controversy around it. Touching on everything from women's solidarity and friendship to forgotten African scholars to the dubious provenance of Kim Kardashian's braids.
Mm.
Very quickly now, the scope of black hairstyling ranges from pop culture to cosmology, from prehistoric times to the Afrofuturistic. Uncovering sophisticated indigenous mathematical systems, the bedrock of modern computing, that exist in black hairstyles, alongside styles that served as secret intelligence networks leading enslaved Africans to freedom, Don't Touch My Hair proves that far from being only hair, black hairstyling culture can be understood as an allegory for black oppression and ultimately liberation.
Woo!
Sorry, it's really boring, probably me reading it, but like I just can't kind of like condense that into
no.
one speech.
So
I better learn how to talk about it better. Sorry.
This is a good dry run. This is like it's how do you feel about white people appropriating dreadlocks?
I don't really care, to be honest. Yeah. Like, seriously. So, oh God. Okay, so I have a chapter on cultural appropriation because I want to set the record straight like, on that whole like palaver as well. So, like, to me, cultural appropriation like evokes such strong emotions because of the context and because of like the history of the recent history of black people and white people together. And as I was talking about Nigeria, but like loads of West Africa, like basically this is a part of the world that's had its cultural, its physical and material resources pretty much like systematically stolen from it. To the benefit of European economies for over 500 years. So this seems like kind of a jump. Oh, we're talking about Justin Bieber's like hair. Why is she going on about this? But you have to think about like the context in which these conversations are like emerging out of. If you look at like Black Americans, where like a lot of the I guess the claims of cultural appropriation come from is like cases in the States. You have these people who are brought there against their will, who have actually been enslaved in that country for much longer than they've been free. And it's only since the late 1960s that there hasn't been segregation. And that hasn't been like legal segregation, but it's actually like remained in many ways. And if we look at things happening at the moment, like Black Lives Matter, we see that really like not that much has changed in many ways for Black Americans beyond the successes of tokenistic, exceptional individuals like Barack Obama. And I guess kind of like other high profile Black Americans that we would be familiar with, but for the vast majority of Black Americans, like they really don't have a great deal. They have something of a raw deal in that country. They also have this culture that just seems to be like the gift that keeps giving. Like, to me, I would say, and I'm not alone in saying this, like there's a lot of theorists, scholars and academics that have done research on this and would back it up. One of the main reasons that like American culture is so like globally seductive and enduring is because of Black cultural production in America. Like, if you look at the music that like most that is big amongst white Americans, most of that doesn't have much sway outside America, maybe like a bit of country here, but it doesn't have the same kind of like global impact. Like, the American music that everybody consumes and is obsessed with, it tends to be, if not black, if not made by black artists, then it's white artists kind of doing black music. So basically, yeah, America has this, it has all this like black cultural production that it can like repackage and present as just American rather than black American. So when you have this kind of cis, and black Americans don't tend to benefit from all of this.
Yeah.
So when you have this happening, like at this kind of like systematic level, and you see, oh, sorry, I went off hair a bit, but like it's also related to hair. But also, let's think about hair specifically. So black people are often penalized for wearing protective hairstyles. So different braided styles like cornrows, locks. There is social stigma around, or even your natural texture.
Yeah.
There is social stigma. There's lots of places, environments that you'll be in where you will be told where the official policy is that your hair is not acceptable. When you then see kind of white celebrities or white artists being celebrated for wearing those same hairstyles, it's a bit like, hang on, like what is this double standard?
Yeah.
Also, they're often not acknowledging where that hairstyle comes from. It's that kind of erasure of the black origin. It's repackaged as something new. On the white body, it's like celebrated, and it's just a bit like, what the fuck?
Yeah, because the Kardashians say it's boxer braids, not...
Jesus Christ. I mean, the Kardashians bring it to just like another level. Like, I think of, you know, the movie Get Out, like Jordan Peele's movie. Like, I think that's kind of an allegory for cultural appropriation, brought to its final and most grotesque stages, where you have these rich white people harvesting like the bodies of black people,
yeah,
actually using their bodies. And to me, the Kardashians are not far removed from that. The Kardashians want to look. The Kardashians make millions from having injected God knows what into their bodies to have the same features that I was bullied for having. It's a bit galling.
Yeah, that is disgusting. I feel so uncomfortable that I'm the same racist. Not that you don't have to fucking make me feel comfortable. Do you know what I mean? It's not your job. Sorry.
Like half my family is white. Like I don't feel responsible for the crimes of like for any of these things. You know what I mean? It's not about individual people. When you talk about kind of whiteness, it's not about individual white people like being bad. It's about stuff that is like way more systematic and institutional. So I don't think any individual person needs to feel guilty. My white grandfather was a flipping like colonialist.
Yeah. Mine too.
Yeah, but mine was Irish.
Oh, Jesus.
An Irish agent of Britain.
Really? Yeah. Where was he based?
Where was he up to his hijinks? All over the colonies.
Yeah.
He was actually from Kilshamar, County Mayo.
Okay. So like the
original Colchi, like where the word comes from. But he was like really like he went to Oxford. He went to Cambridge. He got a scholarship, went to Cambridge, kind of reinvented himself as an Englishman.
Yeah.
And was very anglicised. And he was a civil engineer. His first posting was in Baghdad. And then he went to Trinidad, these were all British colonies at the time. And then finally he went to Kenya. I only ever met him once, because he was a virulent racist and he hated black people specifically. And he was, let's just say, not very impressed with my mother's choice of husband and subsequent offspring.
Oh my God.
So when people talk about, like, I've recently, like, a couple of people were like, oh, Emma's privileged background, of like, what, being disowned by, like, half of your family for, like...
But I think people want to... I think people don't like being told about themselves, and then they like to kind of try and shoot the messenger, and it'll be like, completely, you're from privilege.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, or generally, like the big thing for me as a white person is I'd be embarrassed if people thought I was racist.
Yeah.
But I am like inherently racist. Do you know what I mean? Because I've just been brought up that way.
We have all internalized white supremacy. All have. And obviously that manifests itself in different ways through us, given who we are and what our identities are. And also we can all choose how we respond to that. We all respond to it differently. But we've all internalized white supremacy because it's totally dominant.
Yeah, it's the culture.
Yeah, and we're conditioned and we're fed these messages like all the time. So anybody that's like, you know, I'm not racist. Da, da, da. I'm like, what is it about you that makes you so
special
that you're like immune to this strong propaganda that's being communicated to us at all times? What work have you done to kind of decolonize? What work? Just saying I'm not racist like isn't enough, and it's not believable even.
Because people get so angry though. Like that's they get so
yeah they get more like they get so much more angry than people who are victims of racism.
Yeah,
like it's actually just, what is that? That's a new thing. Like it's in about the last maybe 10 years or so.
Do you think it's
because a new face of racism?
Yeah, because it's stinging, I suppose. Like, because I only recently have close friends of color. Before I have acquaintances of color, but no one like, and. You know, when you've close friends of colour, you kind of... Okay, so I have a comedy show. And before I used to have Cardi B because I really like her music. But I didn't notice that she says the N-word a lot.
Yeah.
And then I'm coming on stage after 3 minutes of that and going, hello. And it was only until my friend came along and was in the audience. And it's so weird because it's like the teacher. In my head, a teacher being racist with... predominantly white children because they never have to think of their behaviour.
Yeah.
Is something that happens.
Yeah.
And like, I just didn't have to think about what kind of music I had on before.
Yeah.
Or who owns the music or whatever. Because I was like, oh, I just like this song. So it's fun and it gets me pumped up. But it's not cool.
Yeah.
Because it's like, either people think I'm being ironic because I'm white and I'm just going, hey, everybody.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and you just have to admit you didn't fucking think about it because you're privileged.
Yeah.
And that's it.
But a lot of people, like, you make it sound so straightforward, but people really struggle with that. So, like, fair play to you for just owning it. People just don't seem able to do that, though. And I don't know what they're so scared of. Like, it's kind of it's so much more kind of honourable and impressive to just, like, stand up, like, own it and try and do better.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. I took it off the playlist.
Yeah.
And the other thing was, I didn't want to put emotional labour on my friends, though. I don't want to go to my friends like, is this racist? Because that's not their job.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's so hard in that respect. It's so hard being white, Emma.
Just wanting to play my Cardi B and be left alone.
Yeah, so sorry. I don't know why.
No, completely.
We'll go back to your book, though. When you say about protective hairstyles.
Yeah.
So the dreadlocks and braids, they're protective as in, like, like, keep the hair out of your face, or what's ignorant on this.
It's a great question. So, the idea of, like, leaving your hair, people always be like to me, oh, what's your hair like down? I'm like, it doesn't go down. Like, it doesn't go down. So I guess there's this universalizing tendency that a lot of, like, the language that we have around hair is language that is relevant to, like, white people's hair, and it, like, suits the kind of characteristics of, or norms of white people's hair. So if you ask me, like, what length my hair is, like, it goes up, like, it doesn't kind of go down. But the idea of just leaving your hair out and loose is not something that's kind of, like, ordinary or normal within like West African cultures. So people, like, the texture of my hair and the shape of my hair, and people who have hair like me, means that it gets dry really, really easily, and it also tangles really, really easily. So leaving it out is quite damaging for it. So you might have an afro that's like, you might have your afro kind of out, I might, but, like, I'll twist it back up at night. And it's called a protective hairstyle because it basically just, it just protects your hair. Like, if we leave our hair out, it's not going to be, like, very healthy. We can't just, like, leave it out and just leave it. It will dry out, it will get tangled, it will get matted. So you braid it. Like, these are braids that are a bit more long term, like, because I'd leave them in for about 2 months.
Yeah.
But traditional, and these are called box braids or singles, but, like, traditional Yoruba braiding, there are, like, hundreds, thousands of varieties, but they're different styles of cornrows usually,
right.
And they could be done, simple ones could be done in kind of 30 to 40 minutes. And women would just keep their hair braided up and then take it out to kind of put in more braids traditionally. So the idea of your hair just being out is not, like, a cultural norm. Obviously people do it now, but it tends to be braided traditionally.
And in West Africa, what kind of, like, products did they use before, like, Madame CJ and stuff
that?
What kind of products did people, because Madame CJ was, like, in America,
yeah,
and she was, I watched a Facebook video about her the other day. But what happened before Madame CJ, like, how did people look after their hair?
So Madame CJ became so successful through, like, a chemical relaxer.
She's like the first black millionaire or something.
Ooh, see, my book now kind of brings to light a bit of controversy. Her former employer.
Right.
Who's called Annie Malone, good Irish name.
Yeah.
Was also a black woman who was the child of escaped slaves. And she set up a business, and CJ Walker was one of her first employees. Then CJ Walker went her own way with a product almost indistinguishable from Annie Walker's and a business structure almost indistinguishable, but was far better at marketing herself.
No.
So one has had a more enduring legacy, even though the other one is actually probably the first.
That is the tale as old as time. That is of someone being a better marketer.
Absolutely. Yeah. And somebody able to turn. Also, Madame CJ Walker can be really seen as, like, an early precursor to, like, kind of today's influencers or, like, kind of bloggers, in that she had this uncanny ability to be able to turn, like, any event of her life into, like, a marketing coup.
Right.
And she was just, like, very, very gifted at that. And, like, very tenacious, and just kind of wouldn't take no for an answer, and very good at networking and getting to know the kind of most influential people of the black world at that time. So there were other products similar to hers, but she was just really good at selling herself.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah.
I'm learning something new.
Before hair straightening. Yeah, so basically women, it's funny because people are going back to those kind of products that people would have used traditionally, which is basically like shea butters, those type of like very kind of heavy kind of oily like moisturizers that like would be kind of organically harvested in that part of the world.
Right.
So kind of like coconut oils, shea butters, all these things that like kind of probably during the 20th century started to be like, oh, these are these kind of bush like primitive like things that we use. Let's buy like shiny, like packaged chemically stuff that's being imported from abroad. And now there's been a movement against that again, and everybody's going back to these kind of like organic, more like cottage industry type things. That's what people would have used previously. And also there's this idea that black women's hair doesn't grow, which is also patently untrue. But around the time of Madam C.J. Walker, a lot of black women in America did have problems with hair growth because of poverty and poor nutrition and just generally like a bad environment that they were living in. But in kind of like where their ancestors had come from, or what people were doing in West Africa, they had like a really heavily nutritious diet, and they had all of these kind of indigenous products and creams and oils to use in their hair. So people actually did have quite like abundant and luxurious hair.
And another question about hair relaxing.
Mm-hmm.
What is that process? And why did that come to fashion?
Oh, wow. Okay. So,
I presume it's the opposite of relaxing, because it feels like the relaxed hair is very different to what natural hair is.
So
this is a weird name for it.
Oh, no, but that's part of marketing. So they use this really like innocuous, gentle, euphemistic word for a process that is actually like very brutal, and uses a lot of very dangerous chemicals that have impacts on your endocrine functioning. They can lead to fertility issues, to different forms of cancer, like hormone disruptive. Like, they're crazy what's in relaxers. I chemically straightened my hair for about 15 years. And I kind of like knew there were all these like things associated with it, but it's just like, I don't know, it's just like that's just what black girls did. Like, you just straightened your hair, and you just wanted to have straight hair, and it wasn't even so just to be normal. Like, it was inconceivable for me that I would have anyone would see my own hair texture. But when black people were first enslaved, one of the stories that was told about them, us, was that they're not really human. So this enslavement is actually like beneficial to them, because we're like bringing them out of whatever savagery was happening in Africa and taking them to the civilized Christian world. And they're not fully human. And one of the ways that we can see this is they don't even have hair. They've got wool that's more like animals. So the idea that like European people have hair and African people have wool, and so are more akin to the livestock on the kind of farms that they would be working on. So there's a whole lot of stigma started to be attached to our hair texture. When you had eventually had emancipation and the abolition of slavery, and other opportunities kind of starting to emerge for black people, there was still this huge stigma attached to hair texture. So for social advancement and assimilation, and just to fit in, people would try and make their hair look more like quote unquote hair, like straight hair. So there were all of these black people are like very, very creative and inventive when it comes to hair. Like, anything anything is achievable. Like, we can make our hair. I'm actually not great with hair myself, but I can always go to a black woman who will be able to do anything with my hair. Right. I can have like a towering afro, or I could come the next day with like a short blonde. Like, we can just do anything with our hair. The possibilities are endless. But straight hair definitely like emerged out of this stigma associated with the hair texture and this desire and necessity of assimilation and social advancement.
Right.
And respectability also. There was this idea, so that kind of, often there's this kind of idea of respectability politics in a lot of black cultures, and, you know, not wanting to be perceived as like wild or kind of like badly behaved. And a lot of that kind of was also concentrated around hair, and the idea of like your hair looked wild or looked unkempt, then you would also be read as those things. So to just try and fit in, really.
Yeah, I read like an article about like Michelle Obama and her hair, and that if she wore her hair the more like natural way, would she be as respected or something? By,
I don't think Obama would have been able to win the presidential election because they would have been like their militants.
No way.
Yeah, definitely. And that's like, you don't see, until very, very recently, you did not see any high profile black women with natural afro hair. The only ones that you can think of are Black Panthers.
Yeah.
They are actually like militants.
It's just mad that like, just a very innocuous thing could be seen as a statement.
Yeah, I know. But I think that shows like how deeply like politicized race is.
Yeah.
Because there's these unspoken assumptions that you just won't. There's these kind of threatening manifestations of blackness, such as hair texture, and just an unspoken assumption that you will do something with your hair to disguise it so that it doesn't look like that. So all this labor is demanded and expected of you, but no one even really wants to know about it. They just want to like see your hair looking normal, and if there's anything that deviates from that, there will be
consequences,
there will be penalties. Yeah, and I think Michelle Obama is a great example. But like another really, I think, powerful one is were those protests in Pretoria High School in 2016, where you had these 12-year-old schoolgirls who were saying, no, we don't actually want to chemically straighten our hair. We just want to leave it as it grows from our heads. And like very neatly like held in ponytails and stuff, but afro texture. And it ended up being a riot with riot police. And you have these images of these little black girls just being like screamed at by like armed men, and it's because they just wanted to like not chemically straighten their hair. It's very, when you think about it, it's like
yeah, that's pretty fucked up.
Meanwhile, Kylie Jenner, is that her name?
Yeah.
I don't know, that lot are being like celebrated and like gasped by these big fashion magazines for like the same hairstyle.
So
that's where the anger about cultural appropriation comes from.
Oh my gosh. I better ask you about your TV presenting.
Oh yeah,
stuff.
Go for it.
Yeah. But thank you so much for like educating me and stuff. Like, just like, because I think people don't get thanked enough for telling people. Do you know, because it's not your job.
Thank
really.
You. It kind of is my job.
I know, no, it's your actual job.
See,
I do.
One of the things about me is like, I actually, my PhD is actually like on race.
Yeah.
So, like, so I'm just like, I know. So I'm like, I do actually do this. But I know with a lot of people, there's just the expectation that just by virtue of them being black, they will be on hand to,
and to also, advise.
Yeah. And I do. Yeah. And I do also do a lot of other stuff. And I'm not like people. Do you know, people are so, obviously people are so rude online, and I get a lot worse than this. But I'll just get these really like demanding and like these really abrupt queries that are actually like quite detailed, but as though I'm gonna like drop everything I'm doing and like write some sort of like essay to like tell, I don't even know, like to, for this person, anonymous person who's probably gonna be, ooh,
I can't believe this. Okay, there's hammering going on the wall. There's a podcast happening. Sorry.
Did that work? It worked.
I think it did. It's,
no. Take that.
Shit. Okay.
Wow.
Do you know what? We'll just go for it. Listeners, there's someone hammering on the wall. You're just going to have to deal with this.
Yeah.
Okay?
It's pretty intense.
So, yeah, you get demands on you to kind of explain stuff.
Yeah, people just like asking me, just like all sorts of stuff. And I just, it's just quite baffling to me. Like, I would never behave like that to like a complete stranger and have this expectation or this sense of entitlement that yeah. they're going to also provide this information that I've pretty much 100% already spoken about at length.
Mm.
Like, just look it up. Like, even just like you'll hear me talking on that topic, and I've said kind of what I have to say. Like, people expecting this kind of tailor-made response to them, and also like kind of demanding it, like in a really rude way.
Well, I just think, like, I presume this person's white that demanded it off you, or I just feel
it
like
happens
some...
it happens a lot, and it would probably mostly be white people, but not always. Loads of people don't have any manners. It's not restricted to race.
I just think people want to be told they're not racist in that situation. Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like people ask you stuff just to go, I'm okay, aren't I?
Or they probably ask me stuff to just, like, contest it anyway.
So yeah.
Like, why are you asking me? Like, you're not going to agree.
So the 6 o'clock show.
Yeah. Slightly different tone.
No, Becca, it's cool. Like, you've done TV presenter before. You've done stuff on BBC 4 and Channel 4.
Yeah, BBC 4, Channel 4, BBC 1 and BBC 2 as well.
You've done all the BBCs. I've
done all the BBCs. I love the BBC.
And you've done stuff about, like, food and stuff before? Like,
Yeah, it's been history stuff. But it's been often the way into the history has been through food. So I'll be co-presenting like with a food historian, and
right.
I'll be doing like the social history. So I've done stuff on like the relationship between Britain and sugar and the impact that had on the culture and the economy, which is massive.
Mm.
I've done other social history shows such as like Back in Time, which is again how people kind of like recreate kind of meals of the past, but also a family will kind of live through these different decades and live and eat as people at that time would. And
oh,
I did that
yeah.
about Caribbean kind of migration to South London, to Brixton specifically. I present our history programme. Again, I do the social history and I present with like an art historian.
Oh my God.
So yeah, mainly history stuff. And then I also do like VTs on the one show. So that would be that's slightly more kind of like entertainment-y stuff. But I've never done live TV before. And I've never really done entertainment TV like this before. So it's quite
yeah.
different. And also it being live is very different. I've
it's
done live
very
radio
scary.
Before, but live TV is another beast altogether.
I keep thinking like anytime I go on live TV, I'm going to swear or libel someone all the time.
I know. It's real rattling.
Yeah.
And also, I've done live TV as a contributor. Like,
yeah.
I don't mind. That's grand, actually. But it's just like having to kind of like be at the helm of the ship. It's a bit like, it's definitely need to get used to it. But yeah, I'm on my like third day now.
And what guests have you had so far?
Who have we had? We had Eddie Reader last night of Fairground Attraction.
Amazing.
Yeah, she was sound. And she'd also been a singer. She'd been a singer with Gang of Four, who are like one of my favorite bands. They used to be one of my favorite bands. So that was cool. Who else have we had on? We had Suzanne
Jackson. Yes.
Yep, Suzanne Jackson from So Sue Me. She was lovely. Last night we had two guys from the charity Alone, who had done the bucket list challenge, where they'd gotten like tattoos. They were elderly men who had gotten their first tattoos,
right?
As part of this campaign to raise awareness and money for the charity Alone, which helps
older people,
yeah, who are experiencing homelessness, and that they were. Just lovely old men. And one of them talking about his tattoo, like it was so he'd gotten his first tattoo, I guess, like in his 70s, which is when he's gone for the challenge.
Yeah.
And it was a bumblebee. And the way he was like talking about it was just like so like emotionally like engaged. And just he was talking about like how much like he loved nature and what the bumblebee like represented to him, and how when he was younger, like there would have been a stigma attached to tattoos, so he never would have gotten one. But it was actually quite like beautiful. I felt quite really moved to hear like an older man like speaking in that way. I do think like generally like people, Irish people, I actually think this is happening like globally. People are becoming like there's more space and freedom for us to like connect with and talk about our emotions.
Yeah,
like a lot of stuff that until very recently had to be repressed for many reasons, there does seem to be like an opening up and this sense of they'll be kind of, there's a freedom and there'll be a support to actually like just kind of talk about how you feel and kind of make these revelations, like have these revelations about, I don't know, things that you've struggled with.
Yeah.
I don't know, like just kind of from mental health to like painful childhood experiences. I feel like all this stuff that we used to really kind of have to bottle up, there's now this scope to talk about it more. Is that something that you notice?
Definitely. Yeah. Especially in older men. Like
in everyone though. But
it's fantastic. Even when the Pope was coming over and people were sharing a lot of clips of that really brave man in the audience talking about his horrible childhood at the hands of the church.
Yeah.
And you know, and talking about his suicide attempts.
Yeah.
And it was just I think the more it's spoken about, the better it is.
Yeah.
It makes me I get horrified at what's happened, but then you process it, like what they're you get horrified at what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And then you process it and you go, it's nice that he was able to feel that he could
share
that. And that we as a country are kind of like being mature about it.
Absolutely. You know? And especially in Ireland, which I think for so long was like had a culture of like secrecy and people like often having like families having like really like dark secrets and stuff, and just like we just don't talk about it, like kind of thing. Like, so I think it's really like it's a really huge cultural shift that like we're able to talk about it. I feel kind of emotional now. I always feel kind of emotional,
especially like sometimes I feel really emotional about Ireland as a whole sometimes, to see like where we are now to where we were 15 years ago or whatever.
Absolutely.
And it's crazy.
I know.
You know?
I know.
It's like living memory. You're like, Jesus, you know?
Like, I'm seeing things in Ireland that I never thought I'd see in my lifetime.
Yeah.
Just having happened in the space of like 10 years.
And I know we should wrap it up, so I'm going to ask you one last question, which is one I've always wanted. I feel so pissed off because we talked, like, it was so interesting listening to you talk about hair and stuff because you're so well versed at it and I know fuck all. And I was like,
this? Than most people do. I know in a natural amount of detail that could veer into the too much detail.
No, but it's like, you know, when you're learning shit, you're like, yeah, more. And then I'm like, shit. So I ran into your ma. She works in the retro clothes shop.
Oh, yeah.
In Georgia Street Arcade.
Yeah, I'm dressed in retro today. I always rock retro.
You must get the best. So retro clothes shop in Georgia Street Arcade. How long has that been going for?
Almost my whole life.
Yeah.
So
did your mum set it up?
Yeah, she set it up. And before she had the shop, she had one of the market stalls outside.
Yeah.
So when I was little, she had a market stall. But she sold... they weren't called vintage clothes then. They were still secondhand clothes. And I think she was one of the first people kind of bringing secondhand clothes like into Dublin.
Yeah.
And I spent a lot of my childhood after we moved back from the States on the ferry over to Liverpool, where she used to go to all the rag yards.
Yeah.
And there used to be these amazing rag yards like down in the Docklands, just full of beautiful old clothes. And because it was before there had been this kind of rebranding of vintage, there wasn't like that much competition, so there was still loads of these clothes. There was a big circulation of them, and we'd go into it'd be in these big like industrial spaces where there would literally just be like high ceilings with piles of clothes from the floor to the ceiling. And because I was like a small child,
you were allowed to run up for it.
I was really good at like, I was light, so I could like go to the top of like the mounds of clothes, and my mum would be like, oh, I need like 15 grandfather shirts, and I'd like pull them out. So I'm sure it was contravening like all these like child labor laws.
So would your mag go like, I need sequins or whatever?
So I need however many like Lurex tops, or or I need like 5 blue like 50s prom dresses, and I'd like get them all out. And then sometimes the clothes would be shipped to Belfast in these bales, and then we'd drive back down. My mum had this kind of like a little mini van thing. It had like kind of it was a low roof, but it was enough for like the bales to fit. And I remember like driving back from Belfast, like just lying on top of one of those bales. It was really uncomfortable, actually. Slightly resentful when I think about it. But so I kind of grew up in the rag trade.
Wow.
Basically.
And it's such an iconic shop in Dublin because it's around for so long.
Yeah, it's changed quite a lot now. It sells more like reproduction vintage stuff rather than actual vintage stuff. But yeah, it's she's been there for years.
That's amazing. And so when you were a teenager, did you work in the shop itself then?
Yes, very grudgingly. Every Saturday, I'd be in there, usually hungover and denying that I was hungover. Yeah, I would be. But then I used to, I kind of got out of that and I used to distribute flyers for the shop around Grafton Street. So I do that with my friends on a Saturday. And I loved that because it was a really great way of talking to fellas.
I'd say so.
Loads of boys.
And what were the clientele like? Like, if you're doing TV shows and social history and you're kind of witnessing it because you're in a fashion shop and you're seeing different people. Like, I presume, like, it went from New Romantics to whatever happened in the late 80s to what kind of people did you see?
So when I was working there as a teenager, that was like in the 90s, in the kind of like early to mid 90s. So it was quite like, it was quite ravery in a way. And I remember my mum designed this kind of baggy tracksuit bomb that she was selling, and like, kind of everyone my age in Dublin had those trousers, so they don't have to like come into the shop to get them. So the clientele has changed, and also like it used to be a lot of like teenage boys as well. Certainly, like when I worked there, it was younger people. It was more kind of maybe teens and people in their early 20s. And now over the years, like the kind of shop has evolved and the look has changed, and now you can see what I'm wearing now, this lovely
beautiful bumblebee dress.
So it's definitely, it's still got men's clothes now, but it's definitely like I would say more of a woman's shop. And it just has a lot of like really beautiful, like stunning dresses, like vintage reproductions, reproduction vintage stuff that you just really wouldn't find anywhere else. My mum has like a very distinctive eye, and I wear loads of her stuff on TV, and like people are always like, where is that stunning such and such from?
So, so you're like an influencer for your mammy. That's so nice. Well, look, thank you so much. We better end this. That was so fun. Thank you.
No, you're welcome. I enjoyed it.
I'm very sad, actually, that my voice is gone and I sound so sick, because I'm actually very happy. I got a big announcement for you. I'm doing a tour of Ireland in 2019, early 2019, and it's gonna culminate on a night on Vicar Street. Yay! I've done Vicar Street before, and now I'm gonna do it again, and I'm so excited. So I'll just quickly tell you what the dates are, because I know I have a bad voice, but sure, look, I've also got information that I need to talk to you about. So on the 25th of January, I'm on in Carlo in the visual. 31st of January, I'm on in the Town Hall, Galway, one of my favourite places to play. The 1st of February, I'm in the Spirit Store, Dundalk. And the 2nd of February, I'm in the Venue Theatre. And then the 8th of February, I'm in Central Arts. And then the 9th of February, I'm in the Whale Theatre, Greystones. And then the 15th of February, I'm in Dreacht, which is in a place that I can't remember because I'm very sick and I've got it written down on paper, so I'm just gonna keep going, and you'll have to forgive me. I know it begins with a D, and I know it's not the dock, it's the other place, and I had a great time there last time and I feel so ashamed. Then the 22nd of February, I'm doing Dolan's in Limerick. The 23rd of February, I'm doing Mullingar. Oh my gosh, I'm doing Mullingar. That's the last time I did Mullingar, my granny got drunk and ended up singing Bad Touch by the Bloodhound Gang. That was about 7 years ago, I'd say. Jeannie Mac. And then the 21st of March, I'm doing the Barras in Clonakilty, which is a great place because they made me homemade brown bread and soup, and it was beautiful. And then I'm on in Cocklands in Cork on the 22nd of March. And the Cork date, and also Dolan's in Limerick on the 22nd. They're on sale now. And so is Vicar Street, and that's on the 30th of March. So you can buy tickets now for actually the Spirit Store, for Cocklands in Cork, and for Dolan's in Limerick. And the rest of the other dates will be on sale soon. I'm also doing a gig in PJ Kavanagh's as well. So I'm excited about that. I better go because I'm very sick, so I'll just do the credits. Thank you so much if you came to the Guilty Feminist in Vicar Street this week. It was so much fun. Gosh, it was like Italia 90 or something. You're all just going mad for Deborah. She's so class. And it was great crack. And the guests were feckin' brilliant. And I'm so happy to be involved in it. I'll chat to you properly again another time when I'm not so sick. I'm actually just tired now. I hope that didn't make you yawn. So thank you very much to Sarah Garvey, who's the amazing producer that is the backbone of this podcast. Thank you very much to Paddy and Alan from Headstuff, who really helped me loads as well. And thank you so much to William Conway, who did the artwork for the Alison Spittle Show. And Bobby Ahern from No Monster Club, who did the music for this podcast. I love making a podcast, and that is all I'm going to say in that matter. Good luck, goodbye, and buy tickets for Vicar Street or the tour, because I'm sick, and I need some assurance that it's going to be okay next year. Good luck.
This podcast is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.